Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about really the evolution of our consciousness, the evolution of our culture, of civilization, where we're going to. And part of that has been a series I've been doing in association with the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. That's ASP. I'm on the board, and tonight's guest is also a board member. That's Jeffrey Gurian. He is a comedy writer. He's a healer. He's a former dentist. He is really covers, I would say, the emergence of consciousness in a sense on many, many levels. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. I appreciate what you're doing. And when I say you sort of cover culture, you have this healing perspective, but you're also very much a part of the mainstream world. I mean, you are out there with the top comedians of our day. And how do you like bridge those two worlds, your healing work and your consciousness work, with what can be some very highbrow and lowbrow entertainment?
Well, it's a good question, and something I've been wondering about my whole life. When I was 12 years old, literally 12 years old, I decided, and most kids when they're 12, they make a decision about what they want to be, and they change their mind a million times. But I decided that I wanted to be a dentist, and I was already writing comedy. So my entire life was that split. And I went on to become a cosmetic dentist that I did for many years, and then wound up being a professor at NYU in oral medicine and orofacial pain, which was my specialty. But as a very young child, maybe 7 or 8 years old, I was given the gift of healing. And I knew it at that age, and it was very strange.
Wait, before we go into the healing, I just have to say, you should write some comedy for dentists, because dentists are known to have the worst jokes.
They have the worst sense of humor in the world. The whole time that I was a dentist, I never wrote jokes about dentistry. For some reason, everybody likes to laugh about going to the dentist, but nobody wanted jokes about dentistry for me. It was very strange. And I wrote for some of the biggest stars, but they never talked about going to the dentist.
Well, it's not a pleasant thing. It's not something people look forward to. But when you're in the chair, like under that laughing gas, and there you're telling the worst jokes, you know, I think they need an upgrade. But anyway, so you were getting into healing as a young child. Talk to me about that. What do you mean?
I have very clear memories of being maybe 7 or 8 years old, sitting on the floor and practicing my touch on myself, on my arm, trying to develop a very light touch. Now, as I think back about it, it's a very strange thing for a kid to do. My parents were not into that at all. No one told me about it. But when my sister, I have a younger sister, when she would have pain, I would put my hands on it and take away the pain. And I would do it on her and myself. And then as I became a teenager and I started going out with girls, a lot of girls would get pain at that time of the month. And I knew how to take it away. I would just put my hands on them. I called it Jeffrey's famous stomach operation. And as a matter of fact, it's on my website. I had no idea that what I was doing was psychic surgery. And many years later, when I actually studied many different modalities of healing, I went to see a healer named Alana Rubinfeld. And she was doing a demonstration. And she had a girl on the table, and she was running her hands along the girl's body. And as she got to the feet, she did a throwing away motion. And after it was over, I went over to her, and I introduced myself. And I said, I don't know how else to phrase this, but were you throwing away the bad stuff? And she laughed, and she said, that's exactly what I was doing. And that's what I used to do. I would put my hand as if it was going inside the person's body where the pain was, and I would take out the bad stuff, and I would throw it away, and then I would go in a different direction and grab good stuff from the universe, and I would pack it in where the bad stuff used to be, and I would smooth it out, and when I was all finished, I would close up like the invisible incision with my fingers, and the pain would be gone. And I just
Intuitively, you just did this intuitively?
I did it intuitively from the time I was a child. it came to me. And then when I graduated from dental school and I went into practice, I noticed that I was drawing a lot of people into my practice who would, well, first of all, people trust their dentist. They trust them more than physicians, basically, because there's a lot of nervousness in choosing a dentist. You know, there's nervousness in choosing any medical professional, but especially with dentistry, because as you said, you know, there's a lot of fear and trepidation, and it usually stems from something that happened to us as children, not as an adult, but as kids. A lot of dentists years ago worked on children who had no business working on children, and they created a lot of fear.
Even today, though, you know, drilling, you know, a tooth is or whatever, it's not a pleasant experience.
No, but there are ways to do it comfortably, and I dedicated my practice to doing that. I developed techniques of injections where people literally didn't feel them. They would ask me, are you going to give me an injection? And I was like, I already did, you know, and I was able to do that.
Oh, that's...
I was able to do that on little
amazing.
Children as well. You know, I worked on a lot of techniques to be very, very gentle. As a matter of fact, one time a patient said to me, he goes, I think you'd rather hurt yourself before you hurt me. And I was like, yeah, that's probably how it goes, you know, how it works. But I noticed that I was drawing a lot of people in who had physical symptoms from stress, migraine-type headaches. You know, in this country alone, there are more than 150 million people who suffer with what they think are migraine headaches when they're really musculoskeletal headaches that are caused by clenching and grinding the teeth. And we live in such a stressful society. The world's always been stressful, but it seems, you know, it seems to be getting more and more stressful. And one of the ways that people respond to stress is by clenching and grinding their teeth. It's a very common thing. A lot of people don't even know that they do it. But when they wake up in morning, pardon me?
Yeah. No, go ahead. When you wake up in the morning,
a lot of times they'll feel tightness in their neck or their shoulders or their back. And it's natural for them. They think, you know, when you're trying to decide what's wrong with you, you use the information that's available to you. So when people wake up in the morning and their neck hurts, the last person in the world they would ever tell would be their dentist. Why would you tell your dentist that your neck hurts, right? So they think they slept on their pillow's no good, or their mattress is no good, or they slept in a funny position. They make up an excuse that makes sense to them. But I know that most of the time a person's neck will hurt if they're clenching and grinding their teeth because they're overworking the muscles of the jaw, which attach in the back of the skull, in the occipital region, in those bones at the very bottom of your skull, in the back of your head. There are two bones that are kind of prominent, and muscles attach there, and when you touch them, sometimes they're very tender, and when a person is clenching and grinding a lot, they can get very severe headaches to the point where they're incapacitated, and they think that they're migraine headaches, and the pain can be so bad that people actually become suicidal because it doesn't let up. So not only that,
it also really is damaging to the teeth. The teeth get ground down.
They get ground down, and that's a very visible sign that you can see. But a lot of people don't notice that. And even when you show it to them, as a dentist, I would take hardcore grinders and show them how badly worn their teeth were. And some people would insist that they don't grind their teeth. That's how much denial there is about certain things. People are very interesting like that. But that became a specialty of mine. So there are a lot of
physical... How do you heal that, though? I mean, if people are sleeping and they're obviously grinding their teeth either because they're angry or depressed or, I mean, through some emotional factor pretty much, or maybe it's a physical TMJ maladjustment, but how do you heal that?
Well, with a body-mind-spirit approach. Some dentists would make an appliance, which I did also. I would make a soft appliance for the bottom teeth to keep your teeth apart when you're sleeping. And some people would give medication as a muscle relaxant. But I used a spiritual approach as well, which is how I came to join the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, because it's not enough to treat the body and the mind by making an appliance or giving somebody a prescription for pills. It's important to try to get down to the reason why they're experiencing so much stress, very often depression as well. A lot of depressed people clench and grind their teeth as well. And so what I found was that the reason I talked about people trusting me is that people would start to open up and tell me about their lives. And they would start sharing stories about their lives, about the stress that they were under. And I was able to share with them ways of coping with the stress, because most people's stress comes from their thinking. Most people in the world who are suffering with depression are living in the past, thinking about what they could have done and should have done at some point in their lives in the past, and then they're living in fear of the future. And meanwhile, today is flying by, and they're losing the moment, and they're not staying in the moment. They're worrying about the past and worrying about the future. So it's very important.
So that's what you would tell people? So how would you actually work with someone to get over their depression or their
Well, it's
stress.
A process. I call it STAR therapy. And STAR is an acronym that stands for Spiritual, Transformational, Affirmative, Resonance Therapy. Now, the resonance refers to three things. It refers to music, because I use music while I work. It refers to my voice, because I speak the whole time that I do it. It's almost like a guided meditation. But it also, most important, it refers to a truth. It's based on the spiritual concept that we're all born with all the knowledge we need inside of us already. You know everything you need to know, but you're not in touch with all the information until someone crosses your path that either says or does something that puts you in touch with that information. So it reaffirms to you what you already know, and it'll feel comfortable. If someone says something to you that you need to hear, it'll resonate inside of you as a truth. It'll feel comfortable. So when people would come to me, and I couldn't do this in the dental office, I would do this outside, they would fill out a questionnaire about their lives, about everything about them. And I would sit with them sometimes for 3 or 4 hours. The first time I would see someone, I would spend a very long time, which was very interesting because when I joined ASP, you know, most classically trained psychotherapists spend 40 minutes to 45 minutes with a patient because that's how they're trained. I didn't have that training. I wasn't limited by that. I believe that you have to spend as much time with a person as they need until they can develop a sense of trust in you in order to be able to share what's really going on with them. So my first visit would be 3 to 4 hours, usually.
And well, most dentists are too busy to spend 3 hours.
Well, that's why I said I didn't do it in the dental office. I would do it outside in another practice. I had a healing center, and that was the technique. In other words, once someone feels comfortable enough to share what's really going on with them in their lives and what their fears are and what their background is, you can usually give them some spiritual wisdom. The S in STAR therapy is for spiritual. Wayne Dyer wrote a great book about every problem has a spiritual solution. It has to do with our thinking. If you give people the correct thought, if they're open to changing their thought, you know, we all have thoughts that we create based on our experience. You know, every thought you have is based on your life experience, and you've been building up thoughts since you're a kid, right? But interestingly enough, some of our thoughts are not valid. And when you have intelligence, you tend to believe your thoughts. Like part of my own personal story, and I think you know this, I was a very severe stutterer until I was in my 20s and beyond.
Yeah, I wanted to go into that because I think that's a really key part of your story and your healing and your gifts.
Exactly. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yeah.
No. Go into that a little bit. Tell us your background there.
I started stuttering when I was very young. Also, probably 6 or 7 years old, around the same time that I realized that I had this healing ability. I was a very, very sensitive child, overly, and I found out since that I'm an empath, and that comes with a whole other thing, you know. It's a gift that feels like a burden. It's a strength that feels like a weakness. When you're growing up that way, when you're so sensitive to everything around you, into people, into colors, into light, and all, and there are people listening to this now, I'm sure, who will relate to that, because there are a lot of sensitives. There's a healer named Nancy Calhoun who wrote a book called Are You Really Too Sensitive? And she calls them ultra-sensitives, people who are ultra-sensitive to their surroundings and to everything.
I'm like that. I feel ultra-sensitive sometimes.
Well, I'm sure that you are, knowing you and how you relate to people. There was a time in my life, if I was with you and you were sad, I was sadder for you than you were.
Wow.
I overfelt my feelings. I didn't have a choice, which made me have to withdraw because it was too painful for me.
How did you get beyond that? How did you...
Well, in learning, all that I've learned in my studying, my first goal was to cure myself of stuttering because my parents took me to many speech therapies and no one was able to help me. And I was determined that I wasn't going to go through the rest of my life as a stutterer because it's a terrible affliction. And I knew that I wanted to work with people and I knew that it would hold me back. Because no one looks at a stutterer and says, what a calm, confident man. That's not the image that a stutterer projects. So I realized one
day... Well, that movie, The King's Speech, was just amazing for that.
Wasn't that incredible?
Yeah. Incredible. And the stakes...
To make that speech to his whole country.
The stakes in that movie, you know, were so high that it's like you're rooting for him, but, you know, so I really feel cause for stutterers, because I grew up with a good friend who stuttered, and you know, I felt so bad because I knew what he was wanting to say, and he couldn't say, and I didn't want to finish his sentence. But
yeah, that's the worst thing you could do. But it's frustrating. You don't know what to do. You feel helpless when you're standing in the presence of someone who's stuttering.
Yeah.
You feel embarrassed for them. They feel embarrassed for themselves. It's a very humiliating problem. I remember very clearly being called on in high school and standing up, and literally nothing would come out. I couldn't get a word out or a sound, and I just stood there, and I turned red until I sat down again. I just couldn't. I couldn't get anything out. There are some
couldn't even get a sound out.
Also a blocker. Besides being a stutterer, some stutterers block certain sounds, and they can't get anything out. And
so
I was determined. I realized one day that I didn't stutter when I was alone. A lot of stutterers don't realize that. I could go into a room by myself, and I could speak perfectly, and I could say all the words that I knew that I would stutter on. I could never say my last name, Gurion.
But people don't usually talk to themselves, though. That's the thing.
And I think that's it. I think that's why people don't realize. I did. I used to talk to myself and wonder why I couldn't speak the way other people did and why I had to have this affliction. And I would talk to myself, and then I realized one day that I didn't stutter on any word when I was by myself. So I started thinking, if I don't stutter when I'm alone, then maybe there's really nothing wrong with me, and it's a psychological thing, because you can't have a disability based on your location. You know what I mean?
Funny.
I mean, if a guy has a limp, he limps in every room of his house. He can't go into a room, close the door, and stop limping. Because if he'd stay in that room all day.
Oh, well, so you're saying at the time they didn't realize it was a psychological thing? They thought it was a physical thing, stuttering?
They don't realize it. There are people in the stuttering world who insist that you can't get better the way I did. I called the Stuttering Institute to try to be helpful because I thought that maybe my technique would be helpful at a big school. And the head of the institute got on the phone because I called as Dr. Gurion, and I guess he gave me that respect. And he literally said to me, no one has ever been cured of stuttering. Those were his words. And I was shocked. And I said, well, you know, then I'd have to be a psychopath to call you up and tell you that I used to be a stutterer, and now I'm not anymore, because I'm speaking to the guy for 20 minutes. I said, have you heard me stutter? Can you even detect that I was a stutterer? And he said, no. But,
well, you know, that's interesting because that person I grew up with, you know, he's gotten much, much better, but he still has, you know, he's still not perfect. I mean, he still has elements of stuttering, even, you know, 50 years later. So he was never really cured. And
well, most stutterers, you can tell that they used to stutter. I released myself completely. And the truth is I could start stuttering tomorrow. I still feel the triggers. But I refuse to allow myself to stutter. I've had it even at ASP. If there's a room full of people, and some of them you don't know, and someone says, you know what, not everybody here knows each other. Let's go around the room and say our names really quick. When a stutterer hears that, they want to jump out the window. because it's one of the scariest things is to be asked to say your name in a group of people. Most stutterers have a hard time saying their own name, and my belief is that because your name is your identity, and if you're not happy with your identity, with who you are, it's very hard to tell it to another person.
But, you know, you've also spoken probably in front of hundreds, maybe thousands of people doing comedy. Yeah.
Well, I've cured myself. I've been on radio.
Well, tell me how
you
cured it. I think this is really, really important if you can tell that process.
It's a process of thinking. I must have been suffering with an inferiority complex. And in order to cure myself, I had to turn it into a superiority complex, not to feel better than other people, but just to feel even. The way I describe it is if you fold a piece of paper in half and you want to get rid of that fold, you have to fold the piece of paper exactly the opposite way, 180 degrees, so that the paper will be flat again. I had to go to an extreme. I had to create confidence for myself. And that had to come through thought. I had to create new thoughts. And that's what I do in star therapy. I look for people's faulty thoughts, for things that they're holding about themselves, for thoughts that they've created. Because remember, you create every thought that you have. Mm. And if some of them are not valid, if you created the thought, you can uncreate the thought. Somewhere along the way, I created the thought that I wasn't good enough to speak the way other people do, that I needed to burden myself with some kind of a disability. And I created this need for myself to stutter. And I had to convince myself what you're really doing is you're arguing with your subconscious mind. As you know, the subconscious mind doesn't know the difference between fact and fiction. It believes what you tell it. So if you tell yourself that you're a loser, then your subconscious mind believes that, and it brings that into your life. And if you tell your subconscious mind that you're a winner, then it also believes that, and then you'll manifest those kind of things in your life. So I had to change my thoughts about myself completely and build up my confidence. And I'll tell you an interesting story. When I went to college, I made myself run for the president of the freshman class. And I couldn't say my name, so I couldn't introduce myself. So I had other kids who acted as my campaign manager. And they would take me around the campus and introduce me to kids I didn't know. And they'd say, this is Jeffrey Gurian, and he's running for class president, and we want you to vote for him. And after I got a little bit, you know, after I said a few words, I could start speaking. Well, anyway, I told myself that if I could win this election, I wouldn't have to stutter anymore. Because you can't win an election if nobody votes for you, right? You can only win an election if people vote for you, and that would make me feel like people like me. So if people like me, I don't have to stutter anymore. Well, I won the election. I was the president of the freshman class, and I still stuttered. And it was a great lesson for me because it taught me that outside validation doesn't work. And that's very important for our listeners to hear as well. It doesn't matter how many people tell you that you're wonderful and talented and fabulous. It matters what you think of yourself.
Wait, let me see if I can integrate that. So you're saying you wanted to feel better about yourself and to get over this because you realized that was the way, but you did feel – so you're saying you didn't feel better about yourself or you did? I'm not sure which direction you went in.
The process was building up my confidence and teaching myself. I created affirmations, which I very strongly believe in, which is the A in star therapy, STAR. A is affirmative, and it stands for affirmations. I believe that you have to retrain your mind. If you want to believe something, like I would create affirmations like, there is no need for me to stutter. I no longer need to stutter. I can speak perfectly.
You did this before reading any of these books on affirmations?
I never read a book. I created it myself,
That's amazing. You were really were gifted with a vision.
Well, exactly. I was given this gift of being I wish I could do it with other areas of my life, to be honest with you. It's one of my greatest accomplishments that I was able to let go of stuttering. And I work with stutterers, and I teach them how not to stutter. You know, are you familiar with the about fear statement that Marianne Williamson uses? Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate.
Oh, right. That we are afraid to shine our light
beyond measure.
Right, right. Nelson Mandela used that line, actually.
He used that also, but Marianne Williamson did it, I think, in A Return to Love. From
I think Nelson Mandela took it from Marianne Williamson.
I believe he did, yes. Yeah, he did.
So and, I know that statement. That's probably her most famous statement, yes.
I use it in all my work. It says, we ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that others won't feel insecure around you. We were born to manifest the glory within us. It is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. I've never come across a statement that's more powerful than that. I held myself back. Mm-hmm. I gave myself a stutter so other people could feel better about themselves. It was like I was sacrificing myself. When I was a kid in school, if the teacher asked me for the answer to a question, I would make believe I didn't know the answer because I didn't want the other kids to think I thought I was smart. Not that they would think I was smart, but to think that I thought I was smart. I don't know if you get the distinction.
I do get that. Yeah. I do get that. And so acted dumb. So
That they could feel better about themselves.
I think something like that too, actually.
Well, we hold ourselves back because we're afraid to shine. And what this statement says, it's okay to be a superstar. Plenty of people in the world are famous. They don't have to feel guilty. And what happens is that when you become a superstar, you act as an inspiration to other people. As we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. So if you see me stop stuttering, that tells you that you can stop stuttering. If I just
I agree. I think that is it's the most powerful statement we can have to uplift all of humanity because we are all great. We all have light within us.
We all have potential. We all have greatness inside of us, but our fear holds us back. Yeah. And the fear starts to develop when we're children for some reason. I don't know what it was that made me think that, but I talk about it in my comedy too, you know. I said if I had a tattoo, it would say born to be nervous. You know?
That's a funny joke.
Some guys have born to be wild. Mine would say born to be nervous because that's how I grew up. Everything made me nervous and I was very, very sensitive. That's not a good combination when you're growing up. It's very hard.
Nervous
to live in the
is
world
really fearful in a way, isn't it?
Fearful of all kinds of things, you know, and a lot of the fear was given to me by my parents, you know,
right.
And a lot of fear, who knows, you know, we all have lists of things our parents gave us that we're not thrilled about, but...
A huge list, and, you know, it's still growing, that list, you know.
Right, exactly, and you know, and it takes, it's a lifetime of work to undo the things that were inculcated into you, either openly or, you know, or quietly. As you were growing up, we're all dealing with that. We're not dealing
and
with
stuff. And if
you
can't blame your parents, who can you blame? That's
exactly
what I say.
Exactly. You know, but then you have to go past that.
Right. Because the parents I had don't no longer exist. Even if they're still alive, you know, they're not the same people. You have to somewhere take responsibility for your own development.
Well, and that's what I did with this. I had to examine all my thoughts and realized that I was holding thoughts that weren't valid for me, that other people, strangers, were nicer to me than I was.
Wow, that's a great, amazing revelation. You mean you were not nice to yourself because of what?
Because of some underlying feeling that I didn't deserve things in life that other people took for granted. I thought that I would never have a career, that I would never be married, that I would never have a family. I even thought I would never have my own apartment. And
wow.
How'd you get over that?
I'm still working on those things.
Well, interestingly enough, I had all those things and more. I became, you know, a doctor, and I had a practice, and I had a wife and a family and a lot of material things.
But how'd you get through that? How'd you get through that old thinking that where you thought you'd never have these to finally having them?
I spent years working on myself, concentrating. You know, when I was able to stop stuttering, it was the hugest thing for me. And I'll tell you, I remember very clearly before I stopped stuttering, I was very nervous to stop stuttering. Can you understand?
I was
in fear. Pardon me?
I mean, you were identified with stuttering, and if you stopped stuttering...
It was
stuttering,
so much a part of me that who would I be if I didn't stutter anymore? As much as I hated it, it was so much a part of my identity, I couldn't picture myself as Jeffrey, a guy who didn't stutter. Because it was that deeply ingrained in me. And I had to change my thinking, like down to the DNA. It was a really laborious process. And I drilled it into myself with a lot of affirmations. I would read about soldiers during the war being brainwashed. They make them say something over and over and over again, thousands and thousands of times. I would make up affirmation cards, and I would take one saying, and I would repeat it all week to myself over and over. I would carry that saying with me in my pocket, and I do that now with people. I make up affirmations for them, and I have them repeat them, and then they change the affirmation periodically. You say it until you feel like you're driving yourself crazy with that, but that's how you imprint a thought into your mind, because nobody learns anything by hearing it once. You hear
right, and when
once,
you change the thought, somehow reality also lines up, and it changes something out in the world as well, doesn't it?
Exactly. Absolutely. And so people always tell me that they get a sense of confidence from me. When I was in practice, patients would come to me from all over, and even if I didn't feel it inside, I learned to project a sense of confidence by challenging myself, by confronting my fear. I did it as a child. I was very afraid of the dark. I remember making myself go in the dark as a child. I hated the fact that I was afraid of the dark. So one night I made myself walk through the dark, as scary as it was. I used to have recurrent nightmares about one of my two grandmothers, that she would leave me in some very scary place. And I knew that in reality that she would never do that. But every night I would dream the same thing, that she would take me to this boiler room and leave me there. And so it was so disturbing to me that one night in my dream, I said to her, "You're not my grandmother. This is just a dream." Mm. And it broke the pattern. And I've told that story to psychotherapists who said to me, that's a very rare thing for a child to be able to do.
But what also is coming through in this conversation, that all those fears and handicaps and ways of thinking made you into a powerful person, into someone who understood human psychology in a way. They were gifts that maybe your soul, spirit, gave you to overcome, to help lift other people up. That's what I'm getting from hearing.
Well, I've come to that conclusion. When I wondered throughout my life about why I had to overcome so many different kinds of obstacles, I realized that it would make me more effective in helping people in the future, because there's very few things that people can tell me that I haven't experienced myself, whether it's deep sadness or depression or divorce or, I mean, all kinds of things that I've gone through that I've had to overcome with thinking. You know, when I was divorced, it created a tremendous amount of pain in my life, but the woman that I had been married to went on to have three other children. She adopted two children, and she had another child of her own, and those two children needed to be adopted, and that little girl needed to be born, and that couldn't have happened had I stayed. So in retrospect, I see the progression. When you look back at your life, you can see why certain things happen and that there's a reason for it. And I have a very big extended family. I'm friendly with my ex-wife. I go to her house for the holidays with her and her husband. When my parents were alive, they would be guests at her house with her new husband. And everybody got along very well because of these certain spiritual principles that are very important to incorporate into your life. And it's
Do you feel, you know, everybody has the capabilities of overcoming, let's say, stuttering or depression, but I don't want to make you sound like special, but what was it that helped in your case that maybe other people don't have or haven't accessed?
That's a great question, and I'll tell you what it is. Determination. I was obsessed. I was literally obsessed with stopping stuttering. And most of the people I work with are not. And I can say that very honestly, no slam against anybody. Most people do not do the work that's required to conquer something like that. I was literally, it's all I thought about 24/7. And as I started to see myself change, it became very exciting to me because I was the project. I made myself a project to become a better person because my choice was staying a stutterer for my entire life.
Wow.
You know, and that didn't seem good to me because there was nobody out there saying, oh, yeah, we have a cure for stuttering. Do this. You know, nobody seemed
to know. You were single-minded in your focus. Did you ever doubt you could or you never doubted?
No, it never occurred to me. I don't think you can doubt it. I knew. What told me was that if I could speak perfectly when I'm alone, I can speak perfectly all the time. Because stutterers only stutter on 10 to 15% of their words. They don't stutter on every single word. There are certain sounds that hold them up, usually hard sounds, like with me, Gurion. I could never say Gurion. D's, hard D's, T's. You know, there are a lot of sounds that are very hard to say for a stutterer.
Right.
And I used to think to myself, you know, if I had to tell somebody something important, would I say, you know, would I start to tell them and then grab myself around the throat and choke myself? I would make it absurd. It's where I used my sense of humor. I would, I would make it seem like an absurd thing to do. If I had something to tell you, why wouldn't I let myself tell you? Why would I block myself?
What is the psychology behind that? Yeah. I mean, behind
I've
not
never
letting
figured
you
that out. And you know what? What I teach people, it's not important to ever figure out exactly why something happened to you, but it is important to look at all the possibilities with an open mind. Don't say, my mom was a perfectionist. She wanted me to be perfect, and I remember her saying it to me, and she always said she never said that, but I would never forget it because it's a lot of pressure. And she wanted me to be perfect, and children can't really rebel. You know, I mean, some kids do, but most of the time, the only way that you could rebel is to try to get even with your parent by doing something. It's like I said, you want me to be perfect? I'll show you how imperfect I could be. I won't even speak properly.
Wow.
You know, there's something in the psyche. Like, I looked at stuttering as a bad habit.
Yeah.
You know, there are only so many habits that a person can have from nervousness. You can twirl your hair, bite your nails, tap your feet, pull your skin, cut yourself, you know. If you made a list of all the habits that a person has, maybe you'll get to 10, maybe 15. I don't know if you could even think of that many. But it's certainly not a limitless number. Well, I look at stuttering as a habit that's related to stress. It's an unconscious choice. No one says to themselves, I think I should start stuttering. But it's some kind of a subconscious choice that you make depending on what's happening in your life at the time. As I said, I started stuttering when I was 6 or 7 years old, which meant I was already speaking for about 4 years perfectly. You know, you start speaking when you're about 2 years
just
old.
I just want to go back to that unconscious choice we make. I mean, we make unconscious choices to let's say be poor, to have a job we don't like, or be in a relationship. I mean, we're making these unconscious choices that aren't in our best interest sometimes. And why? I mean, I know you're not
sure
why,
but based on our own low self-esteem.
Oh, so the whole thing is raising our self-esteem. To say, who am I not to shine my light
exactly,
to the world?
Exactly. Who are you not to do that? Like, what right do you have to think that you can't speak perfectly?
Or be rich, or abundant, or have a beautiful partner, or live in a nice apartment place to live.
Who are you to think that you shouldn't have that?
I think you've just helped me, Jeffrey. I think you've just...
Well, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, it's not like you want to be the president where there's only one. It's like if millions and millions of other people are doing it, who are you to think that you can't do it? It's reverse egotism.
But it's still egotism nevertheless, right?
Well, it's reverse egotism. Instead of saying how great you are, you're thinking to yourself, how different I am. Millions of other people do this, but I can't. So that's what
it's, in a way, it's still egotistical because, I mean, it's reverse egotism, but it's thinking yourself as
that,
special.
It's thinking that you're so special that you can't do it, right? That you're so special in a bad way. And
right.
And that's the kind of thinking that it's important to let go of. And that's the kind of thinking that finally allowed me to start performing comedy. Because,
well, how did you make the jump from, you know, not stutterer to not stutterer to dentist to, like, really performing in front of thousands of people and knowing the top comedians in the world, you know, Steve Martin, Robin Williams, all the, you know, you know, all these
yeah,
people that
Rodney
were...
I wrote Rodney Dangerfield and Joan Rivers and...
Yeah, yeah. How'd you make that leap to be in front of thousands of people from,
well, by
know...
having the confidence that I gained from not stuttering, that gave me the confidence to be in practice, to treat patients, and it gave me the practice. It gave me the confidence to feel that I should know any celebrity, that I was good enough to know them, and that mm-hmm. they should know me. And I used that kind of thinking to meet people because I didn't know anybody in show business. I was, you know, I didn't know one person in show business. I created all that for myself by going out and meeting.
What was your first? How did you first get into this whole thing?
I was making some little silly films, Super 8 films, and they were like false news things, like an item like several men were arrested for smearing cream cheese on the ankles of elderly women who wore their stockings rolled down like bagels. You ever see the old women
funny.
With their stockings rolled down around their ankles? It looked like bagels to me. So I got my grandmother.
That's funny. That is really funny.
So I got my grandmother, who was a kind soul, who had no accent at all. She put on a thick Jewish accent, and she rolled
you
down
the
stocking.
One who used to leave you in the basement by the boiler?
No, that's the other grandmother.
Okay.
This was my mom's mom, my Nana Faye, who was so funny. She had a great sense of humor. She and her husband owned a nightclub. And she was like a show business person. And so she let me put cream cheese on her ankle and make this crazy movie. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yes.
Oh, okay, some noise happened. She let me put cream cheese on her ankles and make this crazy movie. Brought it up to Saturday Night Live, which is another whole story, in the early days of Saturday Night Live. And I met a guy named Alan Zweibel, who has since gone on to become an award-winning writer, producer, director. He does huge things in Hollywood, movies, books, all kinds of stuff. And he called his manager, a guy named David Jonas, and they got me started writing. And I was writing for Dick Capri and Freddie Roman, who were in Catskills on Broadway. And then I got started writing for Rodney Dangerfield. And he was the first big star I ever wrote for, that wound up doing my jokes on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Wow, which joke of yours did he do? I'm just curious.
Oh, well, things weren't particularly politically correct in those days. So he did a joke. One of the first jokes he did was, he said, you know, I only get ugly girls. I went out with this one girl who was so ugly, I bent down to pet a cat. It was the hair on her legs. She was a very, very ugly girl. And then I wrote him a joke. I said, he says, I'm all right now, but last week was rough. He said, I went to one of those custom bed shops. I said, what kind of bed would you recommend for a guy like me? He said, single.
So, that's funny.
So
that's a great Rodney Dangerfield sort of like energy to it, too. That's great.
Well, Rodney was like, he was amazing. He was one of the most fun people that I ever worked with. He was doing my stuff on The Tonight Show, you know, with Johnny
Carson.
That
must have been make you really feel really great, huh?
Oh, it was so exciting. And I got to work with a lot of legends. Milton Berle, you know, Milton Berle was my sponsor in the Friars Club.
Mr. Personality, didn't they call him that?
Mr. Television.
Mr. Television.
Mr. Television,
right.
Yeah, because of it. And you know how he got that name? Because so many people watched his show. They used to line up in the street to watch. You know, in those days, most people didn't have televisions. TV was kind of new in the 40s. And he had this show called the Texaco Star Theater, which was such a popular show that people stood in the street. In those days, they had storefronts with televisions, one on top of the other. And they would put on Milton Berle's show, and people would stand in the street and watch his television show. And they started to buy televisions, thanks to him. And that's how he got the name Mr. Television. And so it was such an honor.
What did you do with him then?
I
How
wrote
did you
jokes
work
for him.
Him.
I wrote jokes for him, and then he became my sponsor in the Friars Club, and we were friends for many years. And I'd be
What
on
was
the
he like? What was kind of person was
he?
He
was a great guy, just a super, super guy. I would be on the phone with him, and I'd be pinching myself. I could never believe it, and I'd say, oh, I'm on the phone with Milton Berle. It's just so crazy to me, you know? There's
well,
whole
you know,
room.
The sad thing is that anyone under 40 doesn't even recognize that name.
They don't know who he is, I know.
No idea.
So, like George Burns. Do you think people know George Burns or no?
I don't think anyone under 40 knows George, especially under 30, I'm sure.
Well,
but, you
probably
know,
not. But
these,
I got
these
to
were
legends.
Legends. Did you meet George Burns?
Sure. I met George Burns. I have pictures with George Burns and with Sammy Davis Jr. and Henny Youngman and Red Buttons and all the guys from the Golden Age. Sid Caesar, who just died in February, this past February at 91 years old.
I just read that Sid Caesar held Mel Brooks out
of the window by his feet.
Until he laughed at his joke or something. Is that true?
Yes. Well, that's the story that Mel Brooks was on, a writer on his show. Sid Caesar was known to be a very powerful man who had a very bad temper. And he lost his temper, and he supposedly held Mel Brooks out of a window by his feet. Mel Brooks just sent me a whole thing, his new set of DVDs, with a thing written on the front, "Good luck, Jeffrey," from Mel Brooks.
Well, I am one person away from the greats. Being you. You know that is amazing that you have met these geniuses. I mean, you know, Mel Brooks. I mean, these are legends.
I've had the good fortune to work with legends, which was amazing to me. And you know, I manifested that by, I think, through thought. You know, there's not a lot of shows that I talk about that in those terms. But with you, you get that kind of thing. And it all came, I think it all stemmed from my being able to cure myself of stuttering, to understand that it's about thought, how you think
about
thought,
yourself. What were you saying? So it's about thought?
No, it's about thought and how you think about yourself and the kind of power that you give yourself. Some people find that there are blocks in life. They can only go so far, and then they're blocked. And very often it's a self-limitation, because we can't see ourselves being wildly successful.
The key is to see ourselves being wildly successful. See it.
I think you have to visualize it. I didn't doubt for a minute that I could cure myself of stuttering. I never let myself doubt it. I was convinced that there was nothing wrong with me. And when I work with stutterers, as I was saying before, that's the hardest thing, is to get them to be obsessed, because most of them have tried a lot of things that didn't work for them.
Right.
And so stutterers have a very negative, they're almost afraid to have hope.
Right.
Because they don't want to be let down yet again, you know? And so I have to try and give them hope.
But you didn't try any traditional therapy, did you? And you
I had
stuttering?
Nobody to help me. I had to do it on my own. That's why I consider it grace. I was given the grace to figure it out. You know, something gave me the knowledge to know what to do.
Your sensitivity.
I believe in God. I believe in higher powers, you know. Something gave me that knowledge that I could do this on my own. But, you know, are you familiar with the Serenity Prayer?
Grant me
the serenity
to
accept
the
things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the most important line, the wisdom to know the difference. If I wasn't given the wisdom to know the difference, I would still be stuttering today. Because, you know, people often tell you, they teach acceptance. Accept who you are. There are some things that you have to accept because you can't change them. Everybody has something about themselves that they would change if they could, right? I think every single person, even the people that we think are so handsome and gorgeous, they have something about themselves that they don't like, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to practice acceptance, because there's certain things that you can never change. But there are certain things that you can change, and that's why that last sentence, the wisdom to know the difference, is so important. If I wasn't given the grace to figure out that I didn't need to stutter, I'd still be stuttering today. But I was able to figure out that if I don't stutter when I'm alone, then it means I never have to stutter. Because why don't I just make believe that I'm alone?
It was a gift. It was a stuttering.
It was a complete gift.
Was a gift, huge gift for you to in your evolution.
Yeah, but you don't realize that while you're going through it. It feels like a huge burden.
Yeah.
There was no guarantee. There was no guarantee that I was going to get rid of it. I was determined to get rid of it. But
you stopped at nothing to I mean, it was like a full-time practice, like you're saying.
Full-time. I couldn't stop. I was literally obsessed. You know, an obsession can be very dangerous if it works against you. You know, drug addiction is obsession, you know, things like that. Obsession and compulsion, you know, OCD, where you can't stop thinking. I couldn't stop thinking about stopping stuttering. I hated it that much. And one of the things that I tell people is, hate the stuttering, but love yourself. Don't turn the hatred against yourself. If you need to keep stuttering, keep stuttering. You'll only stop stuttering when your subconscious mind is ready to let you. You have to convince your subconscious mind that there's nothing wrong with you.
How long did it take you from the time you started when you were starting to totally stop? Do you know?
I'd say it took a few years.
Why
I don't like when I see these things where they come to our stuttering school or whatever for 3 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever. I don't believe that you can stop stuttering in a short given amount of time. But when it's a business like that, they have to charge you a fee. They're not going to say, move in here for a few years. So they do whatever they do. I don't think you can trick your mind into stopping stuttering. I think you have to do it gradually so that it becomes a permanent change. Because a lot of people go through these programs, and their speech seems to get better, but then they slide back.
Wait, so you're saying you were obsessed with this for a couple of years, 3 or maybe 4 years?
Yes, absolutely.
That's what it
took. It doesn't go away right away, and I still stuttered. And as I said, I have triggers to this day. All these years later, I can be in a situation where I'll get so nervous. You know, as I said, at ASP, they'll say, just go around the room and say your name. And invariably, I'm going to be the last one. They always start across the room, so I have time to worry about it. And when it gets to me, I take back the power. I look at every person in the room, and I say to myself, who am I going to stutter for here? Am I going to let that person take away my power?
They're not even taking away your power, because they don't really care.
I would be giving them my power. If I let them make me nervous, I would be giving them my power. Not that they want to take it. They don't even know who I am. They don't care. But in my mind, that's what I create. I'm creating a situation where I have to put myself down to make these people feel better about themselves. So I have to say to myself, I have to use anger and say, who am I going to give my power away to? Am I going to give it to this guy or that woman? Am I going to start to stutter now so that they can feel sorry for me in some way? And the answer is always no, that I don't have to stutter for anybody.
I mean, you're so sensitive. I mean, you're probably still sensitive and empathic. Did that ever change, though? I mean, you know,
it's even more so now, but now I can handle it.
How are you in that? I mean, you know, it can be kind of vulgar, that comedy world. I mean, I think it's funny. I mean, but, you know, it's
stay away from mean-spirited humor. When I used to write for the roasts, I used to ask them, if we're roasting somebody, is there something that they're sensitive about? I don't want to hurt their feelings. You know, some people are heavy and they joke about being heavy. Some people lose their hair and they joke about being bald. But some people are sensitive about things, and I would never write a joke until I asked, is there anything that the person doesn't want said?
So and would they tell you? Would they say that?
Yes. They would say, sometimes they would come back and they say, no holds barred. It's fine. Say whatever you want. But I would always ask, I don't like mean-spirited humor. There seems to be, you know, growing up, kids tend to make fun of each other. There's some inherent thing in human beings. There's some like kind of mean streak that we have. Kids pick on other kids. And I did
it too. Well, to feel better about themselves, probably,
right? Yeah, usually, yeah. But you're supposed to outgrow that. You're not supposed to carry that into adulthood. you know? And so I hate that. There's a lot of comedians in the comedy world who feel the need to put each other down all the time. As, like, guys do that. You know that jock mentality where they're, like, make fun of people who they feel don't fit in or something like that? That kind of thing really bothers me.
So well, it's amazing you've stayed so sensitive in such a harsh world. I mean, such a harsh social environment. I think it's great.
You can't change your basic nature. That's an important message for people. There were many times I wished I wasn't so sensitive, but you can't change who you are. What you have to do is you have to censor who you allow into your life, and you don't let people in who manipulate you because of it. Wherever possible, you try and eliminate people like that. That's why I love being on Sirius XM. You know, I'm on with Ron and Fez on Sirius XM.
I don't know who Ron and Fez are.
Opie and Anthony. They're very well known. They're a very famous radio show that's been around for a long time, and it's on Sirius XM, and it's called The Ron and Fez Show, and I've been a regular for the past year, and I bring on special celebrity guests like Susie Essman and Colin Quinn and Russell Peters and Artie Lang and very, very famous comedians that are friends of mine. I bring them on the show. And what I like about it is that it's not a mean-spirited show. It's a very kind show. It's all about fun and comedy and building people up, not tearing them down. So I wound up on that kind of a show, which is interesting to me because I always wanted to do radio, and then they asked me to be part of their show. And that was like a blessing. I didn't know how I was going to make that happen, and it came out of nowhere. So it's interesting that every once in a while that you can manifest something in your life if your intention is strong.
Well, what do you want to do now? I mean, you've done so much. I mean, I didn't realize that about you because you're sort of a quiet, you know, in these meetings that we're at for this organization, the Association for Spirituality Psychotherapy, which Jeffrey and I are both on the board of.
I'm on the board since 1999.
Well, I've just been on the board the last few years, but and it's a great organization, and I do want to promote that. And you can go to the ASPHealing.org website and look at the past interviews. And also, Jeffrey, your website is
JeffreyGurian.com, and it's JeffreyGurian, as in Nancy.com. JeffreyGurian.com. And there's more up there than you'll want to see. It's about all my stuff. There's a lot of show business stuff. You can feel free to skip that, but it opens up on the comedy page. But there's a menu where it says About, and if you go under the About column, you'll see all about spirituality and healing, my techniques for headache control, and also a whole thing about stuttering. So that if you know somebody who stutters or you stutter yourself, that I like to give people hope that they can be helped, because that message is not getting out to the world, that there is a way around it. And I think it's important. So if you know somebody, ask them to read my website. And if they read it and it makes sense to them, which is what I tell everybody who contacts me, I don't really advertise. People find me on the internet. And and I tell them to read my site. And if it makes sense to you, then there's a good chance that I can help you with your speech problem.
That's
I'm not
great.
A speech pathologist, you know,
no,
and I always
you're
tell
just
them
a guy
that,
who helped himself.
That's what I say to people. You know, if like, who would you rather learn from? Someone who learned from a book, or someone who actually conquered it themselves? Which doesn't mean that you have to have a heart attack to be a cardiologist. You know what I mean? You don't have to.
That's a good joke.
You don't have to have every illness in order to treat it. But when it's something psychological, I think it really helps when you can identify with the problem that the person is facing because you had it yourself. It carries a lot of weight, you know.
But I'm just curious. I was saying, you know, you've done so much. I didn't realize the scope of your sensitivity, but also your achievements. And I mean, what is it that you still would love to do? What do you have your eyes on? What do you want to accomplish in this coming year or the next couple of years? I'm just curious.
Well,
where
I'm
going.
Working on a TV show based on my interviews. You know, I do red carpet interviews in the comedy world. I spend most of my time in the comedy world because comedy is a healing force. And my goal is to put positive energy out to the universe. So I do that on the radio, and I'm working on a thing. You know, I did a book with Chris Rock about a year and a half ago called Make 'Em Laugh, about the history of a very famous comedy club in New York called The Comic Strip. And Chris Rock wrote the introduction to it. And I interviewed Jerry Seinfeld and Billy Crystal and Ray Romano and Gilbert Gottfried and Colin Quinn, about 40 or more of the biggest stars in comedy who came out of that club. And I also do interviews. So if any of your listeners are on YouTube, and they go to youtube.com/Gurian News Network, Gurian News Network, I have almost 400 interviews with all the top people in comedy, Jimmy Fallon and Chelsea Handler and Jon Stewart and Bob Saget and all. And there's talk about taking those kind of interviews and doing a show on the, like, an inside look at the comedy world.
And
that's
nice.
My next goal. That's what I really want to do. Take people behind the scenes, backstage, on the red carpets, you know, to meet the comedians that they love, but to meet them in a real way. Like,
right.
That they know, asking them questions, as opposed to just like a journalist who never met them before. So,
right. I love that Jerry Seinfeld, Comedians in Cars, because you get a really sort of up close look at people.
Exactly,
there.
And that's what I have. So if you look at that website on YouTube, I have, I say, almost 400 interviews already of people, you know, big stars in the entertainment world, and that's my focus, really. I'm working on a podcast. I'm working on a radio show. I just want to put out a positive message to people.
Well, it's amazing that you can. I'm just curious about someone like Robin Williams, or like who's the funniest person in the world, probably the best comedian, and yet so depressed. You think you could have helped him, or what was going on with that? I mean, what do you think?
It's such a sad thing, because to be at that level, there's a great message there. All of us seek to become more well-known in what we do. We seek acclaim. You couldn't get higher than Robin Williams. You couldn't be
or
more
funnier,
famous.
A brilliant, genius comic.
Yes, well, brilliant, but also so well-respected by his peers.
Right.
Loved by everyone in the world. Was very successful financially, you know. What does it take to make a person happy? And yet he must have felt so alone to do what he did.
I know.
It's hard to imagine that there was no one that he could open up to. Because
did you know him? Did you have him?
Yeah, I wrote for him.
Do you think you could have helped him? Not that you know.
I don't know. It would be very bizarre to say. Who knows what could help somebody? I didn't know him well enough to have that kind of a conversation with him. Someone might have helped him, but he would have had to open up to someone and let them know what a bad state he was in, because just before you do something like that, you can't really be in touch with reality. You have to really have kind of a break in your thinking in order for that to be a realistic thing. A lot of people think, oh, it would be easier if I wasn't here anymore. But to actually go and do that, you know, I think at that moment there has to be a real break in your thinking. You know,
I mean, you're right. Someone to achieve the top of the comedy world, loved by the world.
He was an actor and a comedian and just everything, and a dad, and a husband, and none of those things are enough. It seems it has to come from within.
Is that sort of your message here, I think, on this interview?
That it has to come from within, that it's important to work on yourself, that you can't love anyone else till you love yourself. You can't be happy until you've accepted yourself, you know? And we try and trick ourselves with all these illusions of fame and grandeur and, you know,
money and success.
We pick up along the way, yeah. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with any of those things, but they won't bring you happiness.
Someone like Robin Williams, successful, abundant, famous, world famous, it wasn't enough, because what was he missing? I mean, I think just happy
something
with himself.
Inside, some feeling inside that, I guess that was it, that if you don't love yourself enough, you don't see your importance. Because how do you take yourself away from people who love you?
Right.
From a wife, from children? You know, not to be able to think, how is this going to affect my family if I do this?
Well,
you know,
I think
people are thinking clearly. At the moment that they do something like that, they're not thinking it through. I don't think they're really in touch with reality at that point in order to do that. They're not.
Well, I guess the saddest part is here he was loved by the world, but he didn't love himself. That is so ironic. That is just so a shock, you know?
Isn't that amazing?
It's
amazing when you think of that. It's shocking to people. It shocked people all over.
I know.
More so than if he had just passed away from an illness.
Right. I mean, in your world, what was the reaction in the comedy world?
Well, we did a tribute to him on Sirius XM. You know, the reaction was people were horrified. They couldn't figure it out. They didn't understand it. You know, people were overcome with grief. His very good friend, Rick Overton, who's a really good friend of mine, couldn't even speak for hours. He was just so overcome with grief. They couldn't believe it. It shakes you to the core because everybody thinks that if you achieve a lot of success and people know who you are, you know, money and prestige and all, that is enough to keep somebody going. And I guess it isn't. I don't know. I mean, you know, everybody has their bad days. Everybody feels sadness and depression at some point, I think. But
I'm not comparing you, but to him. But I mean, you had something that, you know, you had this drive to love yourself and to feel better about yourself, like that Marianne Williamson quote, "Who are you not to?" I mean, there was somehow.
But I had to work on that. I was determined to fix my mind. You have to make that choice. Not everybody does.
You see, maybe because it was so obviously like off by the stuttering, you couldn't hide that. With someone like Robin Williams, they could sort of get by, and people aren't aware that he's having these thoughts because he probably was on antidepressant or whatever. But maybe in your case, you couldn't. You had to expose yourself to work, so it created more of an incentive to work even harder. Who knows?
So I don't know. In my last interview with him, if you look on my YouTube channel, you'll see I did an interview with him about a year or so ago when he was at the Stand Up for Heroes thing, which is honoring our wounded warriors, and he really seemed kind of sad that day. I didn't see a light in his eyes. He was there, you know. He spoke very solemnly because he was there for a serious purpose, honoring our wounded soldiers, you know, who came back from overseas. And but you can see, or at least I see it. I see the sadness that was there, you know.
But,
and
I mean,
it's a shame. It's a terrible thing. And then 3 weeks later, we lost Joan Rivers.
Yeah, another brilliant comedy. That's a legend. Did you know
her? Brilliant. I wrote for her, sure. I was at her funeral.
You were at her funeral?
I was
allowed
to attend her funeral. I was with her last in June when she was up at Sirius XM to do one of these Unmasked. It's a series of interviews that Ron does from Ron and Fez called Unmasked with very famous celebrities like Joan and Tracy Morgan and the Farrelly brothers, people like that. And Joan was up there, and that was the last time I saw her. We hugged and we took pictures, and she wanted to know about my book, and I wanted to give her a copy, and she said, no, absolutely not. She said, I want to buy a copy. I don't want anything for free. I want to buy a copy because I want to support you and the book, and she had her assistant take a picture of the cover of my book. That's what a kind person she was.
Right. She seemed like a really decent person, I have to say. I say
she's
most
a very
comedians.
Sweet, kind, generous person.
Yeah, I would say most comedians, I mean, like someone like Don Rickles, who seems kind of mean and obnoxious, I think there's something really, you know, genuinely kind about him, you know?
Yes, most comedians, that's a stage persona that they put on. I don't know how they do it, because a lot of them, like Lisa Lampanelli, is such a kind person, and she has, you know, her stage name is like the lovable queen of mean. They used to just call her the Queen of Mean, but now she's the lovable Queen of Mean. She's the kindest, nicest person you'd ever want to meet. So how she gets up on stage and makes fun of people like that, it's a hard thing to do, to transition to become that person. But that's not who she is. as a human being. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that because they see the show and they assume that who you see on stage is who the person really is.
Well, it's interesting. You have such a great window into that world, that you're part of that world and you can really see who these people are. And would you say, like, in her case, comedy is like a defensive mechanism?
Well, she was never happy with her looks, you know. She grew up, that's why she had all that plastic surgery. I thought she was beautiful. When I was writing for her, I had a crush on her, and I never told her. But I always thought she was fantastic. I know, people always say you should have told her. But I didn't want it to interfere with what we were doing. I didn't know how she would take it. She was just a wonderful, wonderful person. And, you know, I write a column every week that covers the comedy world. So I'm out there all the time, and I see the young comics and the older comics. You know, it's on a website called the Interrobang, which is a crazy word, and it's a real word. It means a question mark and an exclamation point. It's called an Interrobang. You ever hear that?
I didn't know that. I have never heard of that, no.
It's an interesting thing. So that's the name of this comedy website, the Interrobang. And I write a column that comes out every week about what's going on in the comedy scene. So it's my job to know everything that's happening, and that's what I try to do, try to stay on top of it.
Who do you really like now? I'm just curious. I know we should go soon, but I'm just curious. Who's really, like, hot and young and, you know, really has something?
You know yet. They're on TV. Oh. You know, Mike Vecchione, Ted Alexandro, people like that, Nori Davis, people who have been on late-night TV a lot, and they're ready to break. You know, all the other people that I know, you know, Jim Gaffigan, David Tell, those
guys.
I
actually don't really know those people.
Well, if people are listening, they'll know. If they're into comedy, they'll know these names because they're on television and they have shows and all. But
who has something like really, I mean, maybe not who, but what is like the fresh approach to comedy? You know, people I think are a little tired of stand-up and doing those jokes and, you know.
There's alternative comedy, you know, like I was recently a judge at the Andy Kaufman Awards.
Oh, really? I loved him. He was.
Yeah, he was amazing. Bob Zemuda was in town. He played Tony Clifton. He was Andy Kaufman's best friend and writing partner, and I don't know if you remember, Andy Kaufman had an alter ego named Tony Clifton.
No, and I didn't know that.
He would dress up as this guy. He was like a lounge singer from the 1940s. Very loud and nasty. He used to have, he would be in makeup for like an hour and a half to become this other person, and Tony Clifton would get his own contract. He'd have his own parking space. It was Andy. But
that's so funny.
And Andy would dress up as this other guy. But once in a while, to confuse people, he would have Bob Zemuda dress up as Tony Clifton. Bob Zemuda is the guy who created Comic Relief with Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and Whoopi Goldberg. Remember that show that used to be
on? Yeah, I do remember that. They raised a lot of money.
Right, yeah. And that was Bob Zemuda, and he's the guy who traveled with Andy Kaufman. I saw him recently.
Was he a nice guy, Andy Kaufman?
Didn't know him.
Oh,
he was one of the few people that I didn't know. Everyone says he was a nice guy. He was kind of strange, you know. But I was chosen to be a judge. His brother Michael does this contest every year, and George Shapiro, who was Jerry Seinfeld's manager, also handled Andy Kaufman in those days. So those guys put together this award show, and it was just a couple of months ago. I was one of the judges. And we picked a new guy. I'm trying to remember. I don't even remember who it was who won. It was a very fun contest. T.J. Miller was the host. If you know T.J. Miller, he's in a lot of movies, and he's on that show on TV called Silicon Valley.
I have one more question about it. It's really current in the news in the world of comedy is that movie, The Interview, that caused a political crisis around the world.
Yeah, I interviewed Seth Rogen about that. Seth Rogen and his partner, Evan Goldberg, are the ones who wrote that movie.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Is that in bad taste or is it any comedy, you know?
Well, it was a weird thing to do in the first place. You know, obviously we're not supposed to be censored by a foreign country. That's ridiculous that they can tell us what we can watch and what we can't watch. Because where will that stop? Every time somebody doesn't like something we do, they'll threaten to do something to us if they don't like a movie or a song or whatever. I mean, that's crazy. I haven't seen the movie. I don't know if it's funny or not. I don't know. But it's supposed to be a comedy, but in the comedy, this guy's head blows up. It's supposed to be very graphic. So it's like a horror scene. I don't know if that's necessary to do in a comedy film, but...
There are some bad tastes that go down in comedy, you know.
Comedy has changed. A lot of comedy these days is very mean-spirited because people are always looking to make a name for themselves, so they want to shock people. Mm. And that's one way to do it. I don't have to believe in that.
Like Andrew, what's Dice Clayton? Was he one of those shocking...
Yeah, I was just with Dice. Yeah, he's coming back, man. He's doing
is he?
Stuff.
I thought he, like, was gone.
No, he's back, man. He was in Entourage, and he's in a new Scorsese film. And I was just with him a couple of weeks ago. He was in New York. He's doing great stuff.
I see. Well, Jeffrey,
I wrote for him. I wrote for him too. Believe it or not.
Oh, could you tell me a Joan Rivers joke that you wrote for Joan? Can you remember anything?
Let me see. She said, she said that she only likes dating older men. She goes, I went out with one guy who was so old, the only thing firm about him was his cane.
You wrote that joke?
I wrote that joke. I wrote many jokes for her, but that's the one that comes to my mind.
That's funny. Wow. Jeffrey, you've had a great career, and I know it's going to continue. And, you know, I love, you know, the aspect of your healing because, you know, comedians, really, these are two worlds apart, you know, the healing, the energy, the consciousness world. And yet, then there's the, you know, the Hollywood, you know, New York comedy world. And you really bridge the two in a beautiful way.
And your
story of healing and sensitivity is just great. So, I mean, it's an inspiration.
Thank you, Alan. It's something that just evolved. It isn't anything that I could have ever planned.
Right. The best ones you can't plan. So give us Jeffrey Gurian.
Not Ben Gurion, no. That was the leader of Israel.
That's right. It's not Ben
Jeffrey
Gurian.
JeffreyGurian.com, JeffreyGurian.com. I'm also on Facebook. You can go to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Gurian News Network. And if your people tweet, I'm on Twitter at Jeffrey Gurian. And I think that's about it. Facebook, and you know, I'm on all social media. If you just Google my name, it'll all come up. Stuttering,
well, you really
healing.
Helped me, like, be inspired and change the way I'm thinking and realize the value of changing our thoughts. So thanks for sharing
thanks,
who you
You've
are.
Dedicated.
Thanks for your contribution to ASP. And I'll see you soon, right?
I hope so. I just wanted to say that you yourself have dedicated yourself to expanding people's consciousness. You do great work in what you do. You put on great programs. Everything that I get invited to that you're involved with is something very special. So I hope you're feeling good about yourself as well because you do a lot of really good stuff.
I am feeling pretty good. I mean, getting acknowledged somehow feels good too. I mean, there's something when, I mean, so it's like I take that in and it's like
it's
also helps. Yeah, support. Exactly.
It's important to honor our strengths as well as to admit our weaknesses. There's nothing worse than false pride, you know. If you're good at something, you know, if I'm good at something and someone acknowledges that, then that makes me feel good because I'm very willing to admit the million things that I'm not good at. So, you know,
well, it's not that you don't have to, we don't,
that.
Yeah,
Everybody
we don't need that
strength.
I think it's great to acknowledge someone and to take it in. You know, when I saw Lily Tomlin in that program, that one woman show she did, she would like pull the applause of the audience into her and she would look so happy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, I think it's good to
performers need that. They live for that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a wonderful thing to be on stage and hear people's response if they're laughing or applauding. It's a great thing.
It is. We do live for that. I mean, that's not only we can't like just live for that, but that's part of why we do what we do because we want to give people something, and if they give us something back, we feel like there's an even exchange. It feels satisfying.
That's right. That's right. So I look forward to seeing you again soon. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
All right. We'll talk again soon. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Very good. Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Jeffrey Gurian. He is really all over comedy matters. You can look up there. He really is a bridge between the worlds of mainstream and the alternative consciousness world. Yeah, well, you can go to comedymatterstv.com also to look at more of his stuff. That's Jeffrey. And his last name is G-U-R-I-A-N. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities.com. Thanks for listening. Good night.